Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I am Brian Dunn.
And I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And we are here to talk about Spillers. And in this case, Robert, I'm talking about Spillers number six. Which just wrapped. Spillers number six did.
That number keeps going up and up and up.
And it's going to keep going up and up and up, I think.
Here's hoping.
Yeah. Okay. Let's hope so. And so one of the reasons why Spillers number six was so successful is because of the participation of our guest. His name is Justin Bigos. He read his short story, The Gas Man. It will be reading, that reading will be episode 49 of the podcast, and he's going to take some time after doing that to sit down with us and chat. So thanks for being a guest on the podcast, Justin.
Well, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Cool. So I guess the first question is, was it worth it driving down from Flagstaff for this? You said your back's kind of hurting you, so.
It is.
You know?
It hurts me most days, so it's okay.
It doesn't? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth it. I mean, I was just mentioning, I hadn't heard Jenny Irish's work before.
Yeah.
Some knockout reading.
Right.
I love that Einstein. I'm biased. I love that Aaron's work. But yeah, it was all really great. And a great crowd, great venue. I had a Hams beer, which I don't think I had since last time. I probably used to chain smoke Pall Mall cigarettes, which unfortunately is true.
Oh, wow. You were a class act back then, though.
Yes, I was. Yes.
Yeah. Older. How long ago are we talking?
We're talking the 90s.
Okay, the 90s. All right. Yeah, you were remarking about the Hams. And
I was very excited about it.
Yeah, you really were. It was...
Special props to the Crescent Ballroom for bringing
out
the
Hams.
It was actually very delicious.
Boy, they're always so great with us.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're both a prose writer and a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I read somewhere that you were being interviewed and you said that you can't be in both modes at the same time. It's either the prose mode or the poet mode. And why is it that those two can't coexist for you and you have to have that line of demarcation there?
Yeah.
What is it about those?
I think that was probably a lie.
Okay.
No, it wasn't a lie. I think
so. This is the more truthful follow-up interview.
Then. Yeah. Well, the reason I'd say maybe it's kind of a lie or just something that I said. Is
you said it to the Collagist in 2015, Justin.
They don't know.
okay.
I think it's actually because of what I read tonight, The Gas Man. I don't think I knew when I was writing that if I was writing a prose poem or a story. And so I think sometimes. When I'm writing, I'm not thinking about narrative necessarily, and I'm not thinking about the line. You know, I teach poetry, so I drive my students crazy by talking about, well, why is your line end here, and why use this enjambment, why pause here? But of course, there's prose poetry. So I think The Gas Man is narrative for sure, but the whole entry of that for me was more of a lyric voice, you know, and so.
Mm-hmm.
I know the distinctions between lyric and narrative obviously can be simplistic and stale, but I do think it's true in general. Though if I'm writing, I think I'm writing a story, you know, versus I'm writing in the line. Writing in the line is a whole other sort of musical constraint on the work that I don't have to really think about writing fiction, writing essays.
Okay. And this story was also written from the viewpoint of a child as well. Is that something that you like to do? Is that something that you excel at, or is that just tough to pull off and you just happen to do it for this one?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's not something I do very often. I wrote a novella called 1982, and it's a child's point of view, but it's not first person, right? So it's a third person attached point of view. And that felt easier because I didn't feel like the language had to be in some ways the diction of a child.
Right.
Right. Where when I wrote The Gas Man, you know, I don't think it has to be a pure mimicry. That's not the point. Everybody knows, I mean, that it's a story written by an adult, not a 5-year-old kid or a 4-year-old kid. That story, you know, in my mind is kind of like late 70s, 1980, where I grew up, kind of nonfiction, honestly. But I wanted the illusion of a child's mind, you know, and so I think that the diction is stripped down. I think there's even a couple moments in The Gas Man where I thought I should italicize the word to show that that's a word that's new to the child's mind. I'm trying to remember one off the top of my head, and I can't think of it. There's a couple moments, I think, where the child does that.
Right.
But, no, I admire people who do that well. because I think it's really, really hard. And in general, I don't care to try it out.
It kind of reminds me of Patrick Michael Finn, actually. So his story was written from a child's perspective.
The war in the rack.
The war in the rack.
The rack, not
being, being one of those things like a child would confuse. He didn't necessarily understand that Iraq was the name of a country. Right. So it was war in the rack.
Yeah.
And that whole story was written from a child's perspective, and it's just got to be the toughest thing to try to sort of inhabit that mindset and think like, how does a child hear? How does a child see? How does a child perceive?
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite poets, is Dean Young, and he wrote a really great book, called The Art of Recklessness. I'm not sure if you've, it's that whole Art of Grey Wolf series. And one of the things, I forget what age he uses, but, Dean said something like, you know, every 6-year-old or every 8-year-old or whatever is a surrealist.
Nice.
You know, and I have a child who's, you know, approaching the age of one. She'll be one in January, and so I'm already anticipating the things that are going to come out of her mouth. Like kids, I don't.
Yeah. You know,
the surrealism.
It is. They're not thinking. Yeah, they're not thinking of being artsy. You know what I mean? But they're just willing. Their minds are unbridled, and they haven't been beaten down the way that the three of us have.
We certainly have, haven't we?
Do we project that onto them, though? Do we look at them and go, wow, that's a very surrealist thing they just said?
I don't think
we see the art when they just see spontaneity?
I guess. It hasn't happened to me yet because she's not talking. She's just making a lot of like pigeon-type noises.
Pigeon-type noises.
Yes, yeah, seagull-type noises.
It's funny that you say pigeon-type noises because it just so happens that you published a poetry chapbook with the title 20,000 Pigeons.
One would suspect that's not a coincidence.
Yeah. I don't think it is.
Yeah.
What's with the pigeons? There are a lot of pigeons on Spillers.
Well, what's interesting is, Joel Salcido, the poet who we had not too long ago at Spillers, he loves pigeons as well. Mm-hmm. And he was excited to come here tonight. I think he got sick and couldn't make it. But yeah, he wanted to check out the 20,000 Pigeons for sure. Mm-hmm. So what's your deal with pigeons, Justin?
I'm gonna
say like no pressure, but he had like a great answer.
I'm much better than mine.
No, I'm just joking.
I live in Flagstaff, Arizona. You know, this is my fourth year living here, but I grew up in cities, mostly in the Northeast, and you know, it's just the birds around, and people often really disparage the pigeon and rats with wings and these sorts of cliches, and so I honestly think they're beautiful birds. And not just the ones that are bred, like, you know, Mike Tyson and people like that, like breed pigeons.
Like the rolling races. Pigeons, amazing, too. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And they're beautiful. They're doves. You know, pigeons are doves. But even the gnarly ones, you know, just walking through the gutter, like, you know, I don't know if we're allowed to curse.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay.
Curse away, damn it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're just like, you know, I'm walking here, you know.
Yeah, right. I'm going to do what the fuck I want.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it was like the last day. I lived in New York from 2003 to 2009, and my very last day of going to work on the train to Midtown, I was shat upon by a pigeon.
the last present,
and I felt really honored by it.
Okay,
it was like my best jacket, and it was just like toxic green slime.
Oh, God.
You know, I'm standing in the subway, and I'm like 8 feet tall, so people are like staring up at me, like I feel really bad. He looks like a green monster right now.
Oh wow!
But it actually made me very happy.
Okay.
But 20,000 pigeons is actually a statistic I read. Those are the amount of pigeons that were killed in World War I in battle.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right? Carrier pigeons were used in battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was such an interesting number. And then reading about the Colosseum in Rome, the same amount of, it was Jewish slaves, 20,000 Jewish slaves built the Colosseum.
Oh, wow.
It was such an interesting thing that just sort of happened in some ways brings that, I hope, that chapbook together.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you have also, you've published a story entitled Fingerprints, right? And you've gotten some notoriety around that, right? Some attention because of that. It was published in McSweeney's Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to get something published in McSweeney's Quarterly? They're notoriously difficult to get into. So what was... Yeah. Did he really just like send it off and wait for them to get back to you, or was there something else? Really?
Yeah, no,
And they did.
So I did an MFA, and then like the adjuncting and blah blah, waiting tables, all of it. It sucked, and so I thought, let me try out a PhD program, you know. And so at some point, I'd take a workshop in fiction, And so I wouldn't have written the story otherwise. I was pretty much set in being a poet, mostly still am. And so I had worked really hard on this piece, and I think I just thought, well, I might as well send it out. I mean, I've worked for hours and hours, and I kept reshaping it and so on, and I'd actually begun it at Warren Wilson years ago. Mm. And so I sent it to, I don't know, a few places, and nobody took it. They rejected it, and I sent it to a few more, and I thought, let me just try one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking, I think maybe to Aaron, but someone said, you know, you should shoot for like one of the big journals or really hard journals. Like they're the ones who take like riskier stuff or something like that. And I thought, well, they're not going to take, but might as well just send it to them. And so after, I don't know if I should really say this, but after like a year or 12 or 13 or 14 months, I saw it in Submittable. I forgot that it was there because, you know, they hadn't replied.
Right, right.
And so I wrote and said, something like, I assume you don't want it. Can you just verify that so I can just pull it and be done with it? Because I wasn't even going to send it out again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? You weren't going to send it out again?
No. Oh. And somebody wrote back and said, no, we're actually, we're strongly considering it. So just hold off, you know? I was like, oh, that's interesting, right? And then maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, somebody wrote, and same person, I think it was Jordan, and said, we want it.
Wow.
You know, and it's like on my phone, it's the last day of teaching class at NAU, I think, for the first semester I taught there. It's like, what? This is crazy. You know?
How cool.
Because, I mean, I love McSweeney sincerely.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, it was a huge deal for them to take it. Like, that was plenty for me for the rest of my life.
I wasn't oh, jeez.
I didn't just stop submitting it all after that.
No, I mean, yeah. It definitely emboldened me, I think, to try out fiction a bit more. To be honest,
yeah,
so it really meant a lot, and they are great editors. So the story, as it appears in McSweeney's, is definitely a different story, and I really admire that about a journal. I know Aaron does that with Waxwing, where it's not just a thumbs up or thumbs down. It's like, I'm an editor, like that means something. I'm going to actually, for whatever it's worth, give you some suggestions. Not as a rule.
Yeah.
And so they had some amazing suggestions, and it was.
Did they really?
Yeah, they did. The sort of zooming into certain phrases, and not just big structural things, but it's like, wow, this is why you're an editor of a really great journal.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, it was a huge deal. And the TC Boyle thing, that was just like beyond. I didn't really quite.
Yeah. Remember. So tell us about that and how that came about. And you're talking about the best.
Fiction. Mm-hmm. So TC Boyle and Heidi Pittler, you know, who does. Most of that work, I think, and narrowing it down before they give it to the, like, to distribute Gino Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
That was, again, just another, it was an email, and the subject line was Best American Short Stories 2016. And I was like, oh, they're going to say, hey, we see that you do a journal. Would you send us some stories or that kind of thing? And I was like, we've taken it. And start to read this message. I'm like, that's just crazy. Like, I'm not that guy.
really
not.
What do you mean you're not? You must be.
Because I think that I still think of myself as a poet mostly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I have the makings of a short story collection, but I'm really slow at it. So I don't know. It's great. It has been a big deal for like where I teach and that kind of thing. And I, you know, some of that career stuff, you know, I don't really want to think about too hard, but I've got a kid now.
You do have a kid.
I've got a mortgage now. And so I'm like, cool, I'll take it. If it helps.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie about that. So.
No. And so you teach at NAU.
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been teaching?
This is my fourth year.
Your fourth year.
I started out part-time the first 2 years.
Okay. And
so this is my second year full-time.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
So no more big guns that you want to submit stories to? Just one more round? I'm thinking maybe you are that guy, Justin. Well, maybe you are a short fiction writer.
Yeah. I mean, I have gone back to the that's why I wrote the novella, you know. And so I've been able to write a few things, and some of them got published. I've got a couple of things out, and they've gotten close at a couple of journals I love.
Oh, wow.
So I think I am starting to do it. But I have a poetry manuscript that's out in the world, so part of me again still thinking of that, and that it's getting rejected, and you know, here and there again, kind of encouraging, you know, semifinalists and things like that. But part of me really feels like I worked on that for a long time, whereas the short story stuff is sort of you know, returning to it, because that's what I started my MFA as a fiction student.
Oh, okay.
You know, back in the early 2000s. So. don't know, it kind of goes back to your question maybe of like knowing if something's a story or a poem. And one of the things I like about teaching at NEU is the faculty, and therefore the students to some extent, I think, are really interested in genre, not as these things that you just show sort of loyalty toward, that you question, and that you don't always have to know what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great examples. Maggie Nelson is one. Some of Stuart Dybeck's work. Some of my favorite writers are, you know, poets and fiction writers.
Okay. Yeah.
And sometimes they're known. They usually are known more for prose, right? Even Raymond Carver, right? Mostly known as a short story writer.
Definitely.
Carver, I think, wrote some wonderful poems, and isn't really, you know, as well known for that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that.
Very
kind of
definitely
stuff,
known as a short fiction.
For sure, and a great, definitely short story writer. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But I put together a tribute panel for Carver at AWP Seattle or Boston, one of those. I forget. It's all AWP's a blur. but it was really cool to have people come and talk after and say, you know, I'm glad that people are talking about the poems.
Yeah.
You know, and this is somebody who has collected poems. Right? This isn't someone who just put out a few books or something, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm interested in that. I'm interested in how those things intersect. And I don't have great answers for it, but I think it leads to really cool discussions in classrooms.
Yeah.
And I hope a little bit here.
No, absolutely.
What do you tell your students when it comes to the subject of where to submit? So, like, you know, you thought, well, when I send out this story, like, I've already sent it out, it's gotten rejected from a bunch of places. Why would I go for one of the big wigs? What do you tell them?
I haven't really told them about my particular habits. anything. That's just probably good.
Do you want them to kind of discover it on their own?
I try not to talk about it too much with the undergrads, to be honest.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a kind of pressure that they don't really need. For the ones who are curious, I love, you know, I've got most of my books now in my office. I got a really cool office at NEU, and all my lit journals are in one bookshelf. I have a ton of them. I've had to, you know, give them away. And so when I can tell when they show up and they actually want to talk about that stuff, then we'll sit and talk for half hour, an hour. I'll let them borrow journals and that kind of thing. But I don't really tell them that they should be sending out, because I think that, well, first of all, teaching poetry to undergrads, the main thing is just to get them to not feel intimidated by it. Because a lot of them feel that poetry is just like this sort of mythical or, you know, it's mystifying to them, you know? And so.
I know a lot of writers who are scared to do the poetry thing because it really looms large, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I try to, you know, mostly teach, at least in the beginning level, very contemporary work, you know, work that's clearly of the world. And I won't use the word accessible because that's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean work that they can relate to in some ways. That's one of their favorite words is relatable. And people make fun of that, but I actually go with it. I think that's important for them to feel a connection to what they're reading and that they're not reading something that requires some other book that they have to go read to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think eventually you do want to read Eliot and you do want to read the modernists and you do want to read books that require you to study.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're starting out, I think it's good to have them read work that feels like it's of the world right now, and they'll respond to that and they'll keep going.
Yeah. You know? So I think we're probably going to ask Aaron, your spouse, the same question, but how does being married to a fellow writer impact your work? And is it what you expected from that kind of partnership, or how do you guys kind of, you know, dance around that whole we're both writers, we're both artists dynamic?
Yeah, I think it's not something we really think about a lot or talk to each other about a lot. We met in the MFA program, right? And so we already knew that we were writers. We met in a fiction workshop with Richard Russo and David Haynes. And, you know, the spark was there and blah, blah, blah. And from this relationship, started dating. So I think we've always seen each other as writers, and that's just sort of like what we do. It's like it's a job, really. And so the main difficulty, especially now with a child, is scheduling.
Yeah,
you know,
how
who
has
gets
that
to write
and things?
It's hard. It's hard. I mean, you know, Aaron wrote a novel couple summers ago and sent it out and kind of needed a break actually from writing, and then Talia, our daughter, showed up, and so Aaron was as generous as she could have been and let me, well, this past summer, spend the first few hours each morning working on a novel of my own.
Wow.
Okay,
that's great.
Something that we had to really negotiate, and so it's something we're figuring out now that we have this extra huge responsibility. Yeah, I read her work. I'm her first reader. I hope I do a good job as editor. I've become more, I think over time, willing to make like recommendations and just sort of like be an editor, like say cross, you know, these sentences, no, so that, you know, no one's feelings are hurt. I think it's hard to do that right away. Like, I don't do that with students. Grad students, I teach grad students a little bit different. But, and she reads my poems, but she's not a poet, so I'm never really getting a critique. Okay. I'm getting a kind of like, this is what I think of this poem. And sometimes it's like, this is okay. Or this is a sort of new thing you're doing that I've seen. So, yeah, you know, so it's good to hear, and she's a very lyric, I think, prose writer. So she's got a good ear.
Sure.
Is to hear even what she thinks. And she reads poetry, you know what I mean? So, I think it's a good relationship, and I think we don't really, you know, stress out too much about doing this thing. I think it was a little weird at first when I sort of returned to short fiction, because for a while it's
did
like
you feel like you were encroaching?
it's my territory.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it was like, it was this thing that we would say. It's like, oh, well, because people would say, well, what it's like, you know, you're both writers, and it was very easy to say, oh, well, he's a poet, I'm a fiction writer, so there's really no competition or anything like that. And it was sort of like, okay, well, now we're both doing this fiction thing too. And she started writing a lot of essay now, and she's got a memoir that she's working on. But I don't know, I think that the honest answer is we trust each other, we love each other. This, I feel no competitive, I would rather her win all the awards, you know what I mean? In all honesty, so there is no tension. Who knows what she'll say when she gets back?
I think we're gonna put her to the test.
You can compare podcasts when they come out.
we won't tell you beforehand.
We'll bind you to secrecy until then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Justin, we really loved you and Aaron coming down here and you reading your story, The Gas Man. Really, just well received by the crowd. So thank you so much for doing that, and thank you very much for being a guest on the podcast.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys so much. It's a great thing you're doing. I used to co-run a series. I know people may not see how much hard work you do, and I know that you do. And to pull off something like this is a great thing for Phoenix. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
All right.